Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the episode-by-episode breakdown of Red Dwarf. I'm Fergus, co-host of The Thing You're Listening To and Red Dwarf Obsessive.
And I'm John, your other co-host on my first rewatch of the show in years. Every episode, a professionally hilarious person helps us make sense of what we're watching. And so does Alex, who produces the pod and edits out all the bad bits. Except this bit. Which is a total hostage to fortune. This time, we're diving deep into Series 1, Episode 5, Confidence and Paranoia, with Matt Blair.
Let's get out there and twat it.
Let's.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company had evolved cat and a hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. The jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
Let's get into it, John. Joining us is a very special guest. This guy does it all. He's a comedian, he's a muso, he co-hosted 107 episodes of the Geekatorium podcast, and he's host of the lovely OPH Comedy Night in London. But most importantly, he's a fan of Red Dwarf. Matt Blair! It's hey. Matt Blair!
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, you're very welcome. It's such a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
It's always nice to just literally... Do you like nerding out on stuff? Yes. Would you like to nerd out and like just make people listen to it? Yes. Yes, that would be great. It's like being at the party and just like, I really want to talk about this thing, but no one else wants to talk about it. But now I get to talk about it and actually everyone might want to listen. So that's actually kind of reassuring. Thank you for the validation.
Hey. you just found the corner of the room that no one else is partying in where there is Red Dwarf discussion happening. You're in safe, you're in good company.
You remember being at those parties when you were just on the cusp of getting too old to be at those parties and there was the little corner of the room of the old people at the parties.
Mm. That's the best corner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh no.
That's what this is right now. This is that corner of the party.
I'll take that. So how old were you when you first experienced Red Dwarf?
I mean, I must have been 10 or something younger. It was through my brother. Because my brother used to watch it a lot. My brother's quite a lot older than me. Like there was 14 years difference between me and my brother.
Oh, right.
So I sort of caught him watching it, and that's also how I sort of got into things like Star Trek. Was my brother watched it, so I watched it, and because it was kind of a naughty show, like your parents didn't really want you to watch it. They didn't stop you, but they didn't really like you watching it. So that was sort of how there's a sort of rebellion aspect to watching Red Dwarf as a youngster, because it wasn't made for my. I wasn't the target audience, but goddamn it, I wanted to be that target audience. You know what I mean? And I think I really only got into it around like season 3 onwards. Like, because in my mind, like when I was younger, like Crichton was always in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't until like years later, I got a VHS and it was, I think 3 or 4 episodes of season 2. This was like, they didn't release every episode on one VHS because there wasn't any room to fit it all on. So it was like 3 episodes of season 2, which was like Better Than Life, Crichton, And
thanks for the memory, I reckon it would have been.
Yes, it was exactly that. I always remember going like, wow, this is the first episode of Crichton, and oh, it's a different person playing Crichton. And I always, like, for years, was like, I'd love to watch the first episode of the new Crichton and how he came into it and all of that. And I got to admit, there was a disappointment when that episode was, it was just a screen crawl of, you know, just going, oh, yeah, no, Dave reprogrammed him and now he's in the crew. Great. As a kid, I didn't really mind that. But as an older person rewatching it, there's a few things in Red Dwarf that's a little bit like, I wouldn't mind a little bit more consistency. I know it's a comedy show, but can we have a little bit more, you know? And it doesn't really have, even when that there's the episode where they destroy themselves in the future.
Yeah.
And he does it by destroying the time machine and it blows up. And you're like, how is this going to continue? And it sort of continues by, time's f***ed. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it just sort of carries on and it's like,
wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of me is like, okay, that's a good joke. But also I'm a little annoyed. So, but yeah.
They do play that joke a few times, right?
Exactly.
Whereas the episode we're talking about today segues perfectly into the next
episode. Yeah, it does continue into the next episode. I remember that was one of the things when I was watching it. I went, oh yeah, this does continue on. This does actually set the scene for something else, which is kind of a first. It's usually very sitcom-y. Everything resets and goes back to the beginning.
Which is fair enough. Until you're one of those guys at a conference asking Craig Charles why in episode 3 he's got a spot on this side of his face, but in episode 4 he's got a marker on the other side. Anyway.
Privately, I am that kind of person, but I don't like to put it out there, you know.
Sure, sure. It's fine to seethe.
Yeah, exactly. Seething is healthy, isn't it? It's healthy.
Surely.
Yeah.
Your first experience of watching the show was series 3. Was a bit of a shock when you went back to series 1, when you first saw that pilot episode. Did you have that experience of going, this is a very different program?
No. I didn't think that at all. I definitely enjoyed it. I like... It's that weird thing that I think that's one of the reasons why things like the Star Wars prequels happened, is that I liked going back and seeing it, because that's kind of what it's like. You see something from season 3, which the beginning of season 3 is very much like an intro in itself.
Mm.
And then watching seasons 1 and 2 is like watching the prequels. Mm. It's an interesting way of doing it.
Was it the comedy that hooked you in or the sci-fi?
A little of column A and a little of column B, I think.
Right.
It's amazing watching back. A lot of it does hold up. A lot of comedy holds up. A lot of it is very dated. A lot of it's very kind of misogynistic and all of that sort of stuff. But when it's just 4 dudes in space all alone, it's going to go that way. So you can kind of forgive it with a sense of logic. It's because it was so naughty and I was so young. And, you know, just and having a swear word that didn't really sound like a swear word, the whole smeg thing, it was just one of the, to call someone at school a smeghead and it not be so obvious to certain teachers or parents.
Mm.
Until it was someone once, I think it was a parent that did actually explain to me what the term smeg meant, and I was disgusted with it. But I think it's just the naughtiness of Red Dwarf. The sci-fi element, I love sci-fi, don't get me wrong. I really love sci-fi. But I don't think it was that really drew me in. I think it was just naughty. That's really what hooked me as a kid. I think the sci-fi probably kept me as I got older, because the concepts on it were really cool. Like if you harken back to like Doctor Who and Star Trek and all of those things, it's actually really good sci-fi in a lot of episodes, like really good sci-fi. This episode, I think, not as strong sci-fi as some of the other episodes, but it's still like a cool concept.
I think it's their first attempt at something they do again better later, the manifestation of the psyche. We'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about that naughtiness a bit more and dig into that, because
sure,
I associate young ones with naughtiness. Red Dwarf was a different type of naughtiness. I think it was maybe a cleverer type of naughtiness.
I think it was less obscene than Bottom, for instance.
Right.
There's a grotesque element about it. The fact that, you know, Lister cuts his toenails by biting them. And for some reason, as a kid, I kind of found that sort of disgusting behavior kind of like role model-y, like, which is exactly what your parents didn't want. But that's what I really kind of like liked. It was like, oh, it's okay to be disgusting. You can be disgusting.
Did you find Lister cool? Did you think Lister was cool in a funky kind of way?
Yeah.
Because it was a shock to me watching the previous episode, Waiting for God, where he's clearly not supposed to be. Mm. Being cool is anathema to the teachings of Cloyster, right? So, like,
yeah, yeah.
I thought Dave Lister was insanely cool. And the squalor was about, oh, I don't care if I've got stuff on me. It's fine. I'm still alive.
Yeah, if you're a young teen, that's rebellious, isn't it? That's what you aspire to not have to care about what you look like and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. It's the nonchalance aspect of it. He wears leather jackets and a cool hat with, like, badges and stuff on it. Basically, if he'd been at school, he'd been one of those guys with the Tippex written all over his rucksack and 100%. All of that. That's kind of what he was. That's sort of... And I think... In a weird way, it influenced that kind of behavior of wanting patches on your bag and patches on your coat and all of that sort of stuff. He did it. And the dreadlocks, the hair, he looked cool. Mm. If they weren't going for that, they should have maybe made him a little bit more ugly, because Craig Charles is a handsome chap.
Oh, yeah.
They kept on doing, they make jokes about him being fat. He was not a fat dude.
No. Slobby kind of equates to, like, indolent, right?
Yeah.
But not necessarily fat. That's a weird, yeah. But then I guess Rimmer's stick thin and insectile in that limmy kind of way.
Yeah, I suppose. But it's that, no, the thing is, though, Rimmer had that awful, like, the hairdo. I mean, Lister was this cool Liverpudlian dude, wore a leather jacket, and like he was and drank beer and ate vindaloo, and like there was just this element of like, ah, he's cool. Yes, slobby, but it was as I said, it's like this like no care attitude that just made you go, yeah, I'd love to be like that. I'd love to be that oblivious to the world and just be in my own sort of head like he is.
He is a humanist, right? He still prizes people, just not stuff, which is amazing. Yeah. But Rimmer, I'd say, to get back to that bottom comparison you were making, Rimmer is self-loathing. Mm-hmm. Richie is self-loathing.
Yep.
And I believe that self-loathing streak runs through a lot of sitcom leads, especially British sitcom leads.
Yeah.
Rimmer's self-loathing seems more profound to me than anyone else's. Richie's is about, oh, I can't shag anyone. No one wants to shag me. Whereas Rimmer's so fundamental and spiritual.
Rimmer knows. Like, he knows that he's an arsehole, but he can't help but be an arsehole. Richard, I think, in Bottom, like, he doesn't really realize he's an arsehole. He's a bit like, but why doesn't anyone love me? Whereas Rimmer's kind of like, oh, I know exactly why people don't love me. I mean, I'll still try and make them love me, but I know exactly why. It's especially in those episodes of like the Better Than Life episode. Like, he knows he is the author of his own like defeat every single time. His parents were terrible from everything that he seems to say. His siblings were terrible from everything that he said. His teachers all like no one liked him. And that's just it's kind of that horrible thing of just if someone had shown him some authentic love, maybe he'd be different. But no one did. Not a single person in his childhood did. No one believed in him. So therefore, he never believes in himself.
That Better Than Life episode is really apposite to bring up there as well. That's an extraordinary depth that I think would be bleakly depressing, frankly, to watch out of context of an understanding that he's to be laughed at in any way. Like, jeez.
And then there's the scene where he sees his father and he thinks his father's just going to say, like, I just wanted to tell you I'm proud of you or something like that. But in the end, he says, I'd want to tell you you're a total smeghead. And he's like, this isn't my fantasy. And Kat comes in and goes, no, it's mine. And it's like, even the people he's with now, like, no one will let him have a semblance of happiness. It's just awful.
Even the cat wants to do that, wants to use his time in a fantasy-fulfilling game to ruin Rimmer's time in it.
Yeah.
That's how much they, oh, wow.
That's the first domino to fall that makes the whole episode fall apart. That's probably what it is.
Oh, my gosh. It was all his cat. Cat is responsible.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing to do now that we're watching it again
at
the age we are, where we can kind of appreciate this stuff a little more. Like, the actual manipulations, the actual way the characters change and are informed and reinformed and revised by spending 10, 12, 25 years with each other. Do you have a particular era that you have as a favourite? Like,
looking back on it, I mean, when you rewatch it and everything, I think you will always find your favourite episodes will be in seasons 3, 4, and 5, and maybe a bit of 6. Obviously, the backwards episode is iconic, and that's a season 1 episode. Like, that is... It's such a strong opener and a great introduction to like Crichton as we now know him. Mm. That era, 3 and 4, like were the start of some recurring jokes and characters that were just so good.
Yes.
So good. I haven't, there's another aspect of love for Red Dwarf that I particularly have as well that I'll mention. When I was doing the Edinburgh Fringe in 2013, I was in a flat and I shared that flat for 2 weeks with Norman Lovett.
Oh wow. My gosh. That's incredible. Awesome. How was he?
He was amazing.
Yeah, of course.
Such a nice man. And for the fact that at one point he'd placed a bet on me and my friend Ivan, he placed a bet. He was just like, there was some Star Wars boxer shorts on the clothes rail and we've got a bet as to whether it's your pair or Ivan's pair. And I was like, well, who do you think it is? He says, I think it's Ivan. I'm like, Norman, you just lost a bet. They're mine. So it's just like, but the fact that it's just like, I'm having a conversation with Holly about my Star Wars underwear. This is such a strange feeling for me.
Worlds colliding.
Yeah. And occasionally he would throw in just like, oh, there was this time when we were recording an episode of Red Dwarf. And he would just voluntarily, he didn't have to ask him stuff.
I was about to ask, like, did you have to shoehorn it in?
No, he would throw, he would just go, oh, there was this one time this and one time that. And it's just like, this is so cool.
He must know. He must know that's what.
Of course he does.
You'd laugh
it up,
right?
He's seen those underpants, come on.
Exactly, yeah. If you're sharing a flat with someone who's got Star Wars underwear, they're going to want to talk to you about Red Dwarf. Like, they really are.
That's a given.
So that was like, that was one of those like, oh, if I could tell teenage me what was going to happen. Like, even though it's just like, you're going to do a show and no one's going to go to it, but...
So worth it.
But you will get to share a flat and eat breakfast every morning for 2 weeks with Holly. It's going to be great.
That's an amazing... Oh, that's I'm green with envy. That's so cool.
It was really cool. The thing that I find, like, in modern time, that is how much Red Dwarf influenced, I think, must have influenced things like Futurama. Because it's so Futurama when you watch it back. I'm certain of it. Things like in this episode, like when Rimmer's like, can you brush my teeth now, Holly? And he's standing there doing all of this. Oh, it's like, oh, can you
Chris
shave?
Barry's
like,
amazing.
And he's doing, can you shave? And then he's doing the exercise routine and all of that.
Acrobics.
And all of that is like, that's just kind of like Bender type jokes in Futurama. It's like robot jokes, but hologram jokes.
So yeah.
Like, how do we, and I watch it and I'm like, Futurama owes a lot to this when I watch
Fry
it.
Fry is a kind of wide-eyed humanist. He's dumber than Lister, but still.
Well, the concept is the same. Main character gets frozen for a long time and then wakes up in the future.
Oh my gosh.
It's the same concept.
You get out of my head. Futurama has aliens. That's the key difference.
So many aliens. So
they just don't live with the aliens. That's the thing in Red Dwarf. They live with each other. They visit aliens now and then.
We could get into a debate about whether or not they're aliens or genetically engineered life forms made by... Let's not do that, though.
Yeah, okay.
It's time. It's time we moved on. Before we talk about the episode specifically, Confidence and Paranoia, mm-hmm. I just got one question. Were we to commit the sacrilegious act of recasting the show for a modern age reboot, who's playing your main guys or gals?
So I have some people here. Now, weirdly, funnily enough, the people that I have for Rimmer and Crichton, I think could be swapped.
Interesting.
So I'll just say Rimmer for the moment. So for Rimmer, and I think it's kind of an obvious choice, you may get this a lot if you're asking this question on every episode, Richard Ayoade as Rimmer, I think would be superb. But I think less so because of like the character he played in IT Crowd, he could be more aggressive like Chris Barry, like he is when he's being interviewed, that kind of like aggressive nerd, that aggressive stuffiness.
Sure, right.
I think would work really well. So I think Richard Ayoade for Rimmer would be spot on.
He's been mentioned for Crichton, but not Rimmer.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Now, do you know who Alfred Enoch is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know he was in Harry Potter, right?
Yes. I think him for Lister.
Oh, you're really going like, kind of, there's a bit of looks casting there.
A bit of looks, but also, I like the idea of getting like an actor rather than comedic actor to play that part. Because I do think he should have some charm. I was looking at lots of different comedians and none of them really, no one screamed Lister at me apart from one, but he's too old.
Oh no.
And the one that I think would have been good when he was younger would have been Mickey Flanagan.
Oh wow.
Because of just the, yeah, you know, he's a bit of a, you know, he's a lad.
Yeah.
He's a lad, but he's, I think he's too old for now. So I was, that's why I was going like Alfred Enoch for sort of looks, but actually good actor.
Okay.
So Cat.
Cat, yeah.
For Cat, someone I've gigged with many, many times and is a wonderful person. And I'd actually, it was Reuben Kay, Australian comic, but who's sort of like an Australian Julian Clary. Kind of thing, always wants to look fabulous, always does look fabulous. But I like the idea of if they made Cat completely sort of like non-binary made Cat a little bit like the Jack Harkness character from Doctor Who. So it wasn't just women he was after, he just wanted everyone.
Yeah.
Just absolutely everyone. Just make everyone a sexual conquest.
Do you know what? Something's never occurred to me that Cat's disgust of human men clearly doesn't, I mean, it's odd that he's attracted to human women in a way. So it makes sense for him just to be pan horny.
Yeah. And then finally, and this is why I was like, this could work for Rimmer or for Crichton. And I'm actually doing a gender swap. I'm going to make Crichton a woman. So it could be a female droid. Or if you made Rimmer a woman as well, that could kind of work, I think, too. Ellie Taylor would be amazing.
Oh, that's a lovely choice.
Having watched her in like things like Ted Lasso and seeing like that sassy sort of thing, like as Crichton, that would work. As Rimmer, that would work. As her being a sort of stuffy asshole, that would really work. Like she can do that really, really well. So I think, yeah, Ellie Taylor as Crichton, Alfred Enoch as Lister, Reuben Kay as Cat, and Richard Ayoade as Rimmer.
What a lineup.
Really interesting cast.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Do you have anyone in mind for Holly at all?
Do you know what? I mean, he's probably too old now, but Arthur Smith, I mean, it would be a good callback for the fact that he was in the Backwards episode.
Yeah.
You can find his Backwards spiel played backwards on YouTube, so you can find out what he actually said.
No, here's the thing. So I know Arthur. So the same year I was living with Norman Lovett, I was working on Arthur Smith's show, and I got to know him a little bit. He's a lovely, lovely man, but he still to this day knows how to speak backwards.
What?
Like he knows. So I did this gig once. I used to run this night called the Distraction Club in London, and Arthur was on. And what we did, he sung Jingle Bells backwards. So we recorded, he sang Jingle Bells fully, like, yep, 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 like he was doing all of that backwards. We recorded it and then I played it back to the audience and it was Jingle Bells, Jingle Bells, Jingle All the Way. And it was like, this is madness.
I'm going to hand over for a little more of a specific deep dive, scene by scene, line by line, right?
Scene by scene, here we go. This podcast is 7 hours long, people. Okay.
There's a lot to say about the show. John, tell us about this one.
Yeah. So confidence and paranoia. Lister visited the officer's deck before it was decontaminated to look for Kachansky's hologram disc. He didn't find it. As the episode begins, he's wallowing in front of a rom-trage. Tragic romance movie, drinking what may well be his own invention, the beer milkshake. That night, Lister wakes up with a fever. He's contracted pneumonia from the deserted officer's deck. For any listeners who recently lived through a global pandemic of a respiratory virus, please ignore the science. But who knows how pneumonia might have mutated over 3 million years? Grant Naylor know, because they wrote this episode. Now Lister's confidence and paranoia have come to life. Confidence, a brash American with a sense of sartorial style that puts Cat in the shade. Paranoia, a depressive little worm of a man who... Oh, is that a urine stain? Moving on. Rimmer warns of the danger and advises Lister he needs to get better. But confidence easily wins the battle for Lister's affections. To make things even easier, he secretly smashes up some medical kit and feeds paranoia to the waste grinder. Confidence persuades Lister to head outside to find Kachansky's hologram disc, which they believe Rimmer has hidden. Confidence is brought down by his own confidence when he removes his helmet because he's really confident. Almost Sophoclean levels of hubris, proving that Grant Naylor deserved their place in the pantheon alongside the Athenian forefathers of dramatic art. But not even Aeschylus could have come up with this closing twist. Lister persuades Holly to power down non-essential systems to bring Kachansky's hologram on stream, yay, only to discover Rimmer swapped the discs around, and there are now two of the Smeghead. Now...
Bravo.
Yes, Aeschylus, why not? Matt Blair, what do you think of this episode?
I actually really like it. It's pure Star Trek.
It is.
It's The Naked Now, which is like a very classic episode of Star Trek, where they all get sort of intoxicated.
Is that original series?
That's original series, yeah. They remade the episode in Next Generation and called it The Naked Time. I think I've got that correct. I may have got it switched around the wrong way. It doesn't matter. But it's that concept of an illness taking over in such a way. Interesting, as you said, ignore the science, because he catches it from going into the deck. Cat doesn't catch it when he steals the blanket from Lister and all of that. Cat doesn't catch. But at the same time, he's not human. So, that's the science. I think it's a very good episode. I don't think it's the strongest episode of the series. But I think its sci-fi concepts are, everything about it tracks,
yeah.
If that makes sense. Everything, Lister's motivation, Rimmer's motivation, Kat's in his own world, so that's fine. And Holly is just kind of that sort of oblivious, everything about it is, it's very Red Dwarf. To me, it's what you said earlier about, it's not like filler episodes. They probably why are there two Rimmers? And they went, this can be an episode in itself. So they ended up squeezing, getting two episodes out of one concept.
Well, interesting trivia for you. This was originally the final episode of the series. And it was going to close, as originally scripted, with Lister's plan working. So he would persuade Holly to power down on essential systems, and Kachansky's hologram would come back, and that was going to be the sort of
the cliffhanger
ending for season two. But I think there was, I think it was a BBC electrician's strike or something like that, meant that Grant and Naylor were kicking around. They were just given some unexpected time to reflect on what they'd done and think about it, and they realised that it would actually be much better if they repurposed another episode and had two Rimmers, so hence everything got kind of jiggled around.
That poor actress probably had other work coming up, and then in the end she gets recast.
Yeah. Cast Chris Barry twice. Why not? It's the age-old story.
It
blew up their gender pay gap. It wasn't a very popular episode with the early fandom either. It was there was a poll in the Red Dwarfs magazine, and this ranked very low with those fans back in the day. That's not to say they didn't like it, but they just preferred almost everything else.
It's not a bad episode. It's just not one of the best. It's not one that you instantly go, oh, I know what episode I'm going to watch. I'm going to watch Confidence and Paranoia. Yes. Unless you're a diehard Craig Ferguson fan.
Well, exactly, yeah. Which I'm sure there are many.
I've got Lee Korn's tattooed on my shin. Maybe an overall thing about this episode is how much they have to condense the actual cool story bit.
Yeah, massively.
The actual bit with Confidence and Paranoia being around.
It's 7 minutes there in it.
I'm fascinated by structure of these things, and you've only got 29 minutes to tell the story, right? The first 3 minutes is that scene with Lister trying to watch the film and Holly banter and Holly talking about Agatha Christie. I'm fine with that. I love that scene.
Yeah, it's great.
But it does mean the rest of it's kind of truncated, right?
The early stuff of Red Dwarf is very much sketches stitched together with a light story.
Yeah.
But that's also what made, I think, Red Dwarf 10 very good, because that's how Red Dwarf 10 felt, those episodes I watched. It felt like lots of sketches put together. And that's why I think I was just like, oh, okay, it is back. It is that sort of thing. Mm. When they started to make it more story-based is when it started losing its charm. That might just be me. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think Grant and Naylor used to sort of act out the scenes as they were writing, so they'd play Rimmer and Lister. And I guess that's why you have a lot of these season one episodes. They'll have their concept, but they won't actually get to the concept until halfway through. That's a bit of a feature of this series.
I mean, it's kind of like The Simpsons, though. It's kind of like that is a lot of how The Simpsons would do things.
Where
there'd be one thing that sets something off, but you actually don't get to the real story until about a minute before commercials. And then that's when the real episode begins.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. It's this long setup to Lister getting ill, and it's not until later that it's like, oh, your illness created these two people. But it takes ages to get to Lister getting ill.
Oh yeah, it's 8 minutes and 45 seconds until that scene where he collapses in the corridor. The reason I have that time code written down, by the way, fans of continuity fun, Craig Charles clearly doesn't know he's on camera for the shot where Kat comes in saying SEX, I think I found it. Because whatever Dave Lister is hallucinating at that point gives him a big old grin in that moment. You'd almost call it corpsing. if you were being cynical.
I love seeing stuff like that. Like there's also like the shoddiness of it. Like when Rimmer is like when him and Paranoia are having a little bit of banter, and there's this moment of where he's going, look at him. He's just like conversing with a figment of his imagination. And the way they edited it, they didn't really hang on Rimmer reacting to realizing he was doing the same thing. And it's as he fades out, he pulls the face and it fades out. And it's like, they don't hang on that joke, obviously probably cut for time, but they don't hang on that joke long enough for it to land properly. They kind of cut off the punchline halfway through. But it's like, it was made in like the 80s. Like they were on a budget, and it's series one. So there's probably just not that air of confidence. Like maybe this isn't as good a joke as we think. So this is a joke we'll cut, but we'll keep this other stuff.
Yeah.
Because we were talking before about how confident their editing is in other places when there's a trick shot.
Yeah.
Like the exploding mayor, or, you know, they're pretty convincing of that stuff.
Love that.
Yeah, they stand up really well for late 80s BBC special effects.
Oh, yeah, no, when confidence dies, like, that's a brilliant special effect an 80s TV show sitcom.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's really good.
It's like the beginning of Scanners. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's funny, I had a really vivid memory of it, because I've not watched this episode in at least 20 years, and I've got my childhood memory of it is that his face became absolutely like ginormous.
Yeah, your imagination takes over.
Yeah, that's what's that called? The mandala effect. There is that scene where Yaphet Kotto blows up in.
Yeah, that's pretty much, yes. Yes, that's pretty much what I was visualizing. Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, what is that film?
James Bond. Isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
It's the voodoo one.
Yeah, Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Can we talk about Cat in this episode? Just briefly. Chicken Marengo, some yet more lovely Danny John-Jules playing that psychopathy of the cat.
He's not really, he's inconsequential to the episode.
Absolutely, like but I still love the stuff he's doing peripherally. Like, it's still good stuff, right?
He sells it all beautifully. Yeah, he's really underwritten in this, but everything is just pitch perfect.
No, but that's the back and forth thing when he comes in and says, "I got your grapes," and he's eating the grapes. "I got you an orange," and he's eating the orange. And then he's like, "Well, I'm so generous, I'm going to go and lie down." And he goes and lies down. And then then Rimmer comes in, he's talking to Lister, but Kat's the one giving all the responses.
Yeah.
And it's just really wonderful, again, very British humour, of like, he's asking the question, Kat answers, even though it's not him, but the answers are perfect responses.
Yeah.
And then he's just like, "Fine, I'm going to leave." And he turns to Lister and says, "How do you feel?" And Kat goes, "Hurt." And
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's lovely. It's
just
lovely bit of writing.
But it's just wonderful writing, the performance, delivery, everything about it is just like boom, 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 boom. Okay, let's get to the story, because that was a sketch. Now we'll get to the story. It's just so, and he performs it so well.
That's really interesting, thinking about them as sketches. You could think that way about the mess hall scene as well, where Rimmer comes in asking for cats.
Yeah, when he's trying to eat the chicken, but he's also like throwing it, pretending it's running away, and he's got to catch it.
Yeah,
and it's a sketch. It's just the rhythm of it. I mean, that's what Cat is. He's just like the way he performs and the way his personality is very rhythm based. You know, he's a funky guy and all of that. You know, the way he moves is important to him. But it does, it comes across in the comedy performance as well, because there's just this rhythm that just works. The beats are in the right places. Everything is just perfect with, like, Danny John-Jules is a great physical and vocal performer. Like, it's just great.
It's an extraordinary performance. Chris Barry helps sell that scene as well, I think, with the escalating disbelief each time he has to come back in.
I love the rhythm of their writing as well. Red Dwarf is full of little comedy earworms, I think, is how I would describe it. Exactly, yes. So many things that you just pick up. And, like, Too Slow Chicken Marengo was just a thing that was said constantly in my house growing up.
And also, I think this episode was the first time of, like, but it, instead of fishy, it was, I'm gonna eat your little chicken.
Yeah,
like, that's
that song. Yeah.
There's a lot of firsts in this episode, because I think as well, this is the first episode to mention Yvonne Magruder.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Who comes back in Better Than Life, doesn't she?
But doesn't look anything like he describes in this episode. Like, she's, like, got a wonky eye or something, and, like, that's why she went with you, because she can't see or any of that sort of stuff.
Because she got hit over the head with a welding mallet, wasn't it?
Yes, that was it.
I mean, that's awful. And then he lies down later on in the episode and goes, ah, Miss Magruder, where were we? Clearly just having had a dream about his mum.
Yes, that's true.
That's not true.
That's true, yes.
None of that is okay, really.
No, it's not.
Wow. I never actually clocked that. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So while I was annoyed with continuity, they do come back to jokes that they do mention.
Yes.
So, like, when they bring back Magruder, they do keep the name the same as this, and you can go back and watch it if you like the prequel way of doing things like I did. It makes sense. It does make canonic sense.
Imagine, Matt, if you will, that you're unfamiliar with the show and you're browsing for something hilarious to watch.
Sure.
So you flick into the comedy section of the BBC iPlayer and you go, ooh, that looks like a sci-fi comedy. I like sci-fi and I like comedy. This might be just up my alley. So you're trying to figure out which episode to watch. Confidence of Paranoia. Oh, interesting title. Mm-hmm. This is how BBC iPlayer sells it to you.
Okay.
Lister contracts a mutated form of pneumonia and his hallucinations turn solid. Fancy giving that a watch?
Did Rimmer write it? That's exactly it. That's how Rimmer describes it. So it's like, so that's...
Yeah, solid.
I know, but I kind of like that, only because I know the episode. But I like the fact that they actually just describe it like Rimmer describes it. That's brilliant.
Though, if you were trying to sell it to someone else to watch...
No, that's not how
it's described.
Those are
the last words you would use.
It's not a thing. It's like, is there someone at home going, darling, have you ever seen Red Dwarf? No, it's a sci-fi sitcom. Oh, right, yeah. There's an episode here where someone's hallucinations turn solid. Right, put it on. I love comedies where hallucinations turn solid. That's brilliant. In fact, anything that turns solid.
But is also probably how an episode of Star Trek would be written on iPlayer.
It probably is, actually.
That is, like the original series or even the animated series, that's how it would be described. I don't know how I would describe this episode. I mean, even just like, just, is it funny to just describe the episode as Lister contracts a 3 million year evolved version of pneumonia? Like,
that straight away is more interesting, I'd say, than someone's hallucinations turning solid.
Can we also talk about, though, how another thing that this episode, and you might think, what? But at the same time, you may agree that this episode did involve a large quantity of animal cruelty.
They were dead. If we talk about the fish, they were dead when they came into the
studio. One fish was not. There was one fish that was filmed that was flapping around and very alive for however long it was being filmed. There was one live fish for one shot.
Ed By and Paul Jackson, the director and the producer, had a momentary disagreement between them. Ed By was shooting the fish flailing around on the ground.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, I think we need to get a bit more. And Paul Jackson, usually quite a hard nut producer, was the guy who went, no, he's had enough, and like ran in and put the fish in a bucket.
Amazing. Well, okay. But that wouldn't happen now. They'd be animatronic, CG, or anything like that. But that was a real fish flailing about on the floor.
It's like the rat scene in The Abyss. It's like, whoa, okay. This is happening.
Yeah.
That is a fish.
I was just kind of taking the piss. I don't really see it as big animal cruelty. I was doing a bit.
Oh, I see. I'm very naive. I'm genuinely one of those naive people who will hear something like that and actually be a bit tedious about it.
I loved that you already had like a response to it already lined up. That's great. It's like, no, it didn't really happen like that.
It's fine. Just for any animal lovers out there, it's fine. One fish was harmed.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Blimey. Well, we learned in this episode that love, according to Lister, is what separates us from animals. He is a big softie in this episode.
He is. No, because he cries like openly to movies. Long before Tom Hardy did it in an advert for Kleenex. But he openly weeping, drooling even. Like the beer milkshake was spilling over him and all of that. Like, and but that was really, that was different for its time, for the
80s. Yeah.
You know, men being very open, like openly crying, just watching a film. You're right. He is a big softie. And the whole thing is about him like having some regret not asking Kochansky out. And it's about him taking the leap to actually do it as well, though it doesn't work out for him at the end. But he takes the leap. He's just like, you know what? I'm going to do it. Like, my confidence and paranoia have both died, technically. So like, but I'm still going to do this. I'm still going to do it. And you're absolutely right. He is a softie.
Yeah, it's quite a vulnerable performance. I love the way that Craig plays the fever, like his illness. He really, you know, coming back to the whole, is he meant to be cool or not? He does proper man flu stuff. I mean, he's really kind of back to childhood, the way he gets out of bed and just kind of don't feel well. I think it's really, really nice and interesting how he plays that.
Yeah. When he's on his own in the corridor and he has to say, I don't feel well, and then collapse, that's a tough gig for an actor, right?
It is.
Oof.
And the makeup sells it, like the sweatiness and all of that. It's all like very believable. Like no point you're just like, well, this is a sitcom. No, you are like into it. Then the very Marx Brothers humour with the scutters. You know, poking him in the eye with the thermometer.
They are like the Three Stooges, aren't they? Yeah. Those three scutters. Is this the first time we've seen the scutters kind of properly engaged with activities as well? They're kind of floating about the place.
They've had their nice don't leave us with Rimmer gag and the beating their little robotic heads against the wall, and then they've been in the cinema, haven't they? This is where they really get to cut loose with
the proper interaction. That's nice.
And that ends with some extremely 80s BBC special effects there with the blatantly sped up
it's very Benny Hill. It really is. But they also do it the other way around, like when they're in space, they do slow down bits. When he jumps around the banister, when he jumps around the railing, they slow it down and then he lands and then it's back to normal speed. But it's very well done. But again, it's an 80s sitcom made in England. Like, how?
Knowing it was coming this time, the sped up wheelchair bit, I was watching Chris Barry.
Yeah.
Knowing that his reaction would be sped up. And sure enough, Chris Barry's a consummate pro. He plays it and it looks completely natural.
And he stays completely still and it works. It fully works. It's brilliant. Yeah.
There's some uniquely Red Dwarf world building in this episode, isn't there? I just wanted to mention Necrobics, the Love Celibacy Society.
Oh, that's very ahead of its time, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
love celibates.
Well, it's incels, isn't it?
It feels quite, exactly. It feels quite 2023. Love is a sickness that holds back your career and makes you want to spend all your money. Amazing.
And a bit of invasive technology with the dream recorder. How do we all feel about that?
It does make you think, like, what was the purpose of that? Like, what was the higher purpose?
Does the ship have that technology?
Yeah.
Psychiatrically, like the therapists on board probably needed it because they are traveling in deep space for a long, long time. They're going to need like full details on, because if someone goes f***ing nuts, they need to know why, to make sure no one else goes f***ing nuts, and they need to know the warning signs. And maybe I'm reading too much into this myself, but
that fits with the pattern of Holly stating that his prime directive is to keep Lister sane.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. That's very true. That's why Holly's brought back Rimmer so that he doesn't go back and go insane. Yeah. Another thing I'd written down when I watched the episode, I was like, if I'd never read Murder on the Orient Express, I'd be very annoyed with Red Dwarf.
Because
he does give a massive spoiler for that book.
It does sound like nonsense. It sounds like a joke.
It does.
But it is literally the plot.
It is literally. I think they all did it.
He's very clever. Of course he's going to know.
Does anyone know what the Doctor Who connection is? It's a doozy.
Ooh. I'm thinking Craig Ferguson, Lee Korns. Were there either of them in Doctor Who?
It's not by any chance Paranoia's costume is an old Doctor Who costume from the William Hartnell era.
No, although that is plausible. So it is to do with Craig Ferguson. So Craig Ferguson used to be a drummer in a punk band. And this is, I love this. They were first called the Bastards from Hell.
Okay.
And then they renamed themselves the Dream Boys.
What?
Yeah, it's quite a switch. The lead vocalist of the Dream Boys was one Peter Capaldi.
Okay, nice.
And it was apparently Peter Capaldi who persuaded Craig Ferguson to try stand-up.
Really? Holy smokes.
There we go.
Which presumably led him to, well, to this.
He was a bigger man in this episode, wasn't he, Craig Ferguson?
He was, yeah, in every sense.
He looked like young Trump. That's before even, I think even Trump then didn't look quite that bad.
The costume is outstanding. Oh, his teeth are phenomenal, but the costume is amazing. I love Confidence's costume. It's
abrasive. It's in your face. It's Confidence.
I read that Craig Ferguson and Lee Korns also auditioned for Lister and Rimmer, respectively.
Did they?
Yeah, makes sense.
They're not actors. You know, it's kind of carrying on that tradition that we've seen with previous episodes where they've, rather than casting actors or even comedic actors, they've just brought in some guys who've gigged with other guys off the stand-up circuit.
Yeah.
Yeah, using the personas they've already developed on the alternative comedy scene.
We've got to talk about Lee Korns because he deserves a mention. We can't possibly not talk about Lee Korns and talk about this episode.
I didn't really recognise him from anything else. He has a familiar face, but I looked him up and I was just like, I don't think I know him from anything else.
He's only ever had the similar sized part to Paranoia, really, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And he only has maybe, what, like three or four lines in the whole thing and then is killed off off screen?
He is murdered off screen. It's like flipping Game of Thrones around here. Yeah, no, he was in, we were talking about just before, what was it, John? He was in all of Blackadder?
He was in several series of it, yeah.
Ed also said he was the physics teacher in Grange Hill.
Oh, wow, okay.
Right, yeah. Amazing. And I remember him from The Young Ones, definitely.
That's probably where I recognise him from.
Matt, have you got a favourite moment or line from this episode?
I think my favourite moment is the scene with Kat where he brings the grapes, it's not the grapes, and then he thinks it's the orange and it's not the orange, and then he lies down and then he asks him, it's just that delivery at the end of, it's like, how do you feel? Hurt? There's just something about, it's just it's the best written scene in the whole episode, and it just really, like, it's not even really about the whole episode, and that just for me is just, that delivery is just so good.
Yeah, it's great. It just pips for me. It just pips the Agatha Christie gag, which is similarly really just chef's kiss writing. But yeah, Matt, thank you.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. It's been really fun talking about it and like getting into the nitty gritty. I like it. Thank you.
Oh, that's cool. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you if they just simply cannot get enough, Matt Blair?
Well, they can find me on Twitch. Matt Blair UK is my Twitch handle. I do games. I do music. I do trivia. I'm just generally a bit of an idiot. And I run a comedy night in Chiswick, the Old Pack Horse, the OPH comedy night, and it's the last Thursday of every month. So do make sure you can get to that. I'm just search Matt Blair and look for the guy that looks like me.
Matt Blair. What a guy.
What a guy. That was amazing. He gave us a lot of time there. I think, good luck getting that down to an hour, Alex. There was a lot going on.
It's all gold as well.
It really is. It really is. Tough choices. Do you know what? Hopefully this will be the last time I say this, because it's kind of the point of the podcast, but getting all these different opinions, it's awesome. The fact that all five of our guests have had something very different to say about the show.
Yeah.
It's almost like a conversation's happening between them. Do you know what I mean? Like Sue's in episode 3 talking about how amazing the cat is, immediately followed by Paul, who felt the cat was underwritten in those early series. You know, they should all get in a car park and have a fight at the end of the whole thing and see who's right.
Well, maybe we need more of an audio. What's an audio version of a fight that would work on a podcast?
A rap battle.
A rap battle. Okay, right. Let's email everyone. Alex, is that all right? You've got no problem emailing everyone inviting us to a rap battle, right?
Sure.
That's not burning your credibility in the industry at all. Do you know what? It's not just the guests that are having opinions. We have friends of the show now, by which I mean friends on social media. So actually, coming back to what you were just saying about Paul and Sue's having different views of the cat, Richard on Facebook has commented, thank you, Richard, to say he respectfully disagrees with Paul's view of the cat. So Paul, if you recall, reckons that Cat is behaving like a psychopath, whereas Richard's take on it is that his complete disinterest in the old man dying is still the funniest bit of the ep. He is a cat, says Richard. We don't need to paint a human psychological character profile onto him. I love this.
Ouch.
Well, yeah. No, it's not. I don't think it's about that. I think, like you say, it's awesome to hear all the different opinions. You know, me coming back to the show for the first time in several decades, I was looking forward to reminding myself what I loved about it, but I'm loving hearing also what other people love about it, because it's making me see it in different ways. That's what it's about. We're not trying to, you know, establish the facts. We weren't there. We don't work on the show.
We're lovers, not experts.
Exactly. Yeah, it's about people's passions. What do people love about it? And that's inherently personal, right?
Do you think a comedians, by the nature of their jobs, tend to frame opinions quite vociferously?
Yeah, it can be hard to disagree in the heat of the moment. That's absolutely true. Yes, I mean, I've definitely caught myself listening back to these saying, yeah, to a point that I, in hearing it again outside of the conversation, go, I mean, maybe. So
we should get more of these, right? We should get more opinions. Please, if you have agreements, disagreements, tidbits, send them in. betterthanlifepod@gmail.com. Email us, get in touch on socials. We want to hear from you.
At It's BTL Pod on Instagram, on Twitter, X, on Facebook, all those good places.
Lovely. Actually, can I bring one up? A lovely listener, Shelley, has got in touch. Do you remember last week I mentioned that I felt like a Modo?
Yes, and we had the whole swearing conversation, all the made-up swears.
Shelley got in touch to say, just listened to the latest ep and wondered if you knew that Modo is apparently Proto-Slavic for testicle.
That's fantastic.
So that's what I was feeling last week. And presumably that's what Rimmer intended to call the captain and the cat when he called them a Modo. It's not a... he's studying Proto-Slavic,
yeah,
apparently.
Absolutely.
Or knows it already. Let's wrap up Confidence and Paranoia. I had a couple of little things I wanted to mention.
Go for it.
First of all, just as a little aside, we get another alien reference.
Ah, we do.
In this episode. We got one last week.
Yeah.
With the facehugger impression this week. In Confidence and Paranoia, we got In Space No One Can Hear You Cha-Cha-Cha. So, there's a bunch of things that could be going on here. Is Doug Naylor or Rob Grant? I think it's Doug Naylor, because I think it carries on after Rob Grant's involvement in the show. I'm sure I've seen it in episodes, series 7 or 8, reference to Alien. But anyway, is it them having a joke about the fact that aliens don't exist in this universe, so they keep referencing the one film that really does kind of rely on, you know, existence of Alien? Or is it simply that they love the film and want to homage it? Or is it simply that the Alien saga, the series of films, exists in this universe, and so people have seen it?
I like that.
But why would they be referencing it? Alien, the film, came out like 9 years before series one, right? 8 or 9 years before series one of Red Dwarf. So it's not zeitgeisty.
It would have been considered seminal quite quickly, I reckon, right? I don't want to say it was a game changer for the genre, but it was doing stuff in motion picture sci-fi that hadn't been done before, right? It was a different take. Very scary.
I'd say the fact that Star Wars came out 2 years before Alien was quite a significant thing. Star Wars is a used universe. Things do look a bit run down in episode 4 to 6, but there's a very clear definition of good and evil. There are alien races. There are lots of different planetary races. Some have bums for faces. But I think the key thing overall is actually that in Alien, these guys are space truckers, right? I think Guy said that even in episode 1. But it's a used universe. It is run down. It's supposed to look shoddy. This is what a spaceship would look like if it had gone to Jupiter and back, or indeed 3 million years across the galaxy. Things ain't going to look pretty. Things are going to be utilitarian and grey. And maybe that's the link. Maybe that's why they're homaging Alien.
Or it could just be that it's living in their head, and that's a funny twist on the log line. I'm sorry, but I've fixated now on what you just said a moment ago. I like the idea that in the future, if there are aliens, we're going to need, inevitably, because we're humans, we're going to need a sort of anti-alien xenophobia campaign to be mounted. And I'm just imagining the cheesy song featuring the lyrics that you just inadvertently created. There are lots of different alien races. Some have bums for faces, and I can just hear that to a strummed acoustic guitar, which reminds me of Lister's Indling song.
What do you think?
It's awful.
Right, okay.
Musically, lyrically, performatively, it's awful. But it's meant
it's to be. It's supposed to be, right? Right,
yeah, okay. Of course. We've already heard Rastabilly Skank. We know Lister has bad taste in music.
And we know he might know more than one chord, but he only ever does one chord per song, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What I don't get, confidence is supposed to be a manifestation of this virus that presumably instills one with confidence. Mm. The purpose, if there is an intellectual one, being that you can instill so much confidence in someone that they die because of their overconfidence and yep. think, oh, I can jump out of the ship, or I don't need to wear a helmet in space, or I can stand in this fire for a bit, whatever. Like, if I'd just done a song in public and someone came up to me going, hey, that was the best song I've ever heard, and then the main thing they described was their love of the rhyme scheme.
Mm.
That is the equivalent of going to see a friend in a play and commenting on the lighting afterwards, right?
Yes,
like,
it is.
There's, if someone said that to me, oh, I love the rhyme scheme, I'd be like, oh my God. Oh, I have to stop. I'm never writing a song again. That's terrible.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. No, I mean, there's hip-hop where superficially you could go, oh, one of the things I really love about this song is the rhyme scheme. But actually what you mean is the wit of how the words are rhymed, usually. There's no wit in the Indling song. Kindle, dwindle, dwindle. That's, you know... yeah. I mean, it's witty in terms of comedy writing, but taken at face value as an actual love song, a lament that Lister has written, kindle, dwindle, and windle is not, as confidence says, so deep. It's just rubbish.
Do you know what? By the same token, if I'd just done a thing in public and this guy in a tight-fitting suit with pallid skin eating yogurt said, oh, you look ridiculous doing that, I'd be like, yeah, I know, no change. Thanks for the comment. What is confidence and paranoia's plan here? They kill each other. Like, what? That's not a... Is it a virus? They're not very good at it. They're not very good at being a virus. You'd have thought after 3 million years, they'd be champing at the bit to mess up someone's days.
Yeah, they fail to spread, don't they? I mean, like, you know, just drawing on recent history, you know, with COVID, you'd have the newer, stronger variants coming out and they would displace the older, weaker variants. I guess if COVID was made manifest, maybe it would... You know, Omicron would decide to take out Delta or whatever in the same way. But obviously that's not really what happens. It's just they're more infectious and more successful at spreading. But confidence is not very good at spreading. Okay, he can't spread anywhere. And maybe that's the answer. Maybe he commits suicide because he realises he's got nowhere to go.
Well, it's a last salvo, right? It's a Hail Mary. He must be taking off the helmet to show Lister that Lister can take off his helmet.
Yes, yes. Right?
Look, watch this, Dave, and takes off his helmet.
But how does it help? How does it help spread the virus?
Well, I guess if he hadn't died, then Lister would have gone, oh yeah, no, it doesn't. But then, at the same time, who's the virus going to spread to? A hologram?
Mm.
A cat? Like, there's not many places for confidence and paranoia to go.
That's true.
After this one host.
Maybe the weakness of this virus is the fact that its hallucinations are so dependent on the individual, right? Confidence and paranoia is not inherent to the virus. The hallucinations are inherent to the virus, but they come from whatever the people give. So Lister references the confidence and paranoia theory, doesn't it?
Mm.
And even personifies it. And Rimmer references the, you know, the exploding mare and the rain of fish, and then they're in Lister's mind. So they it's just to spread, isn't it? That's what a virus wants to do, is just to spread. But how is blowing up Lister outside the spaceship going to achieve that?
If there are any virologists in our listenership, please write in. Tell us how. Tell us what you think confidence and paranoia were up to, why they manifested in the way they did.
I genuinely would love to know if there's a proper scientific theory available as to why they might be doing it.
Let me take it away from the viral idea a second and just talk about the characters of confidence and paranoia. Confidence is absolutely full of confidence.
Yeah.
He wears those clothes, he has those teeth, he has that voice and that demeanour. He's very, very confident. I would say that paranoia is very, very confident. He speaks up to insult people. He eats 3 million-year-old yogurt.
Mm. Yeah, that is confident.
That's stuff that if I was paranoid, I wouldn't do myself.
Yeah, so you'd just be gibbering in a corner, yeah.
The logline for this show is Comedians Talk Red Dwarf. Maybe it should be Comedians Overthink Red Dwarf. Like, if we just change
at this point, we're just two blokes who invite comedians on to talk about Red Dwarf and then hang around to take it way, way more seriously than it should be taken.
Oh, I like it. As I think you said it last time. If not now, when?
That's the real question this podcast seeks to answer, yeah.
And on that note.
On that note.
Next week is an absolute doozy. We've got Nick Helm talking about Me Squared, the series finale, before series finales were a thing. A tiny bit of continuity between the episodes as well, from Confidence and Paranoia into Me Squared. That's really exciting.
Yes, yes. It's not immediately undermined in Holly's opening crawl this time.
There are
two rimmers.
And a real, maybe the first true manifestation of Rimmer's self-loathing. Like, we truly get to see it writ large in this episode for the first time. There's plenty of other opportunities and plenty of slightly subtler ones this series. But in terms of just, oh, wow, this guy is not okay. Me Squared is quite a big sign.
And who better to take us on that journey into the psyche of Arnold J. Rimmer than Nick Helm?
Exactly. See you then.
Bye-bye.
It's better than life.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.